What are Canada's foreign policy aims in taking such a hard line against Iran? Why has Russia joined the fight against the Islamic State in Syria? And how is their involvement affecting US-NATO ambitions? How successful were economic sanctions in forcing the hand of the Iranian state? What strategies have been used against Iran in the past, and how likely is a war with Iran in the future? How does the Iranian nuclear deal serve as a weapon against Russia? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we set our sights on some of the recent maneuvers by the West in and around Iran and Syria. We'll be speaking to senior lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne, Binoy Campmark, about the Canadian government's ambitions with regard to the developments in Syria and Iran. Then award-winning author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Darius Nazemroya joins us to share his perspective on the real motivations behind the recently signed Iranian nuclear deal and how it is expected to impact countries like Russia. On this week's program, Canadian and American subterfuge in Syria and Iran, conversations with Binoy Campmark and Mahdi Nazemroya. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 9th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is anything but selective about the head-chopping, culture-erasing monsters besieging Syria, CIA-trained or not, stating last week, quote, "If it looks like a terrorist, if it acts like a terrorist, if it walks like a terrorist, if it fights like a terrorist, it's a terrorist, right?" The US and UK, of course, are both bombing and supporting insurgents entirely illegally in Syria, having no UN mandate and no request from the country's governing body. Vladimir Putin had said, quote, "We have an invitation and we intend to fight against terrorist organizations and them only," unquote, possibly referring to allegations that the US has been targeting Syrian government sites and military personnel. That comes from the article, Syria: Russian Intervention Exposes Coalition Lies. The Terrorists Are Us, by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted October 7th. The Russian Air Force has been pounding terrorist targets across the Idlib governorate for the last few days, as well as ISIS strongholds in the east at Rafah. On Sunday, according to a report filed by South Front, roughly 700 militants surrendered to members of the 147th Syrian Tank Brigade shortly after bombers had attacked nearby cities of Mardej, Maharat al-Numan, Jisr al-Shukur, Sarakib, and Samin. Russian bombers will soften targets on the front lines, ground troops will move into position, and untold numbers of jihadis will either flee, surrender, or get cut down where they stand. Bottom line, Syria is not going to be a quagmire as the media has predicted. To the contrary, Putin is going to cut through these guys like crap through a goose. That comes from the article, How Putin Will Win in Syria, by Mike Whitney, posted October 7th, originally appearing in Counterpunch. In a Financial Times op-ed, former Carter administration national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski irresponsibly said Russia, quote, "launched air attacks at Syrian elements that are sponsored, trained, and equipped by the Americans, inflicting damage and causing casualties," unquote. Washington has, quote unquote, "only one real option," he claimed, "to protect its regional interests," quote, "to convey to Moscow the demand that it cease and desist from military actions that directly affect American assets," unquote. He stopped short of explaining their ISIS and other imported terrorists, not moderate Syrian opponents, one of many big lies about Obama's war, systematically destroying another country. Instead of applauding his righteous efforts, Brzezinski urged, quote-unquote, prompt U.S. retaliation. Is he suggesting possible nuclear war? That comes from the article, Dangerous Crossroads, Lunatics in Washington Want Direct Military Confrontation with Russia, by Stephen Lendman, posted October 7th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Last July, world powers arrived at a deal to lift international sanctions on Iran in return for curbing its nuclear program. Canada, however, appears to be offside with traditional partners like the US, UK, and France, and are maintaining their sanctions and their hard, hostile line against Iran. To help contextualize Canada's foreign policy stances in light of the nuclear deal and the current aggression being waged in Syria, we are joined by Binoy Kampmark. He was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge, and currently serves as Senior Lecturer in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. A frequent contributor to the Global Research website, he joined us in the CKUW studio in early October. Is there anything that you've noticed that concerns you specifically about the way Canada has been conducting itself on the world stage?
Yes, I think one of the things that is very conspicuous is the, you know, that remarkably hawkish warring agenda which Harper has embraced, and where that fits. Effectively, it works on a few levels. It's a kind of a demonization that is functioning on the policy platform, and so it's the idea of seeing it's the Islamist debate. Of course, it's the idea of how do you combat Islamic state and so forth. And what is happening in the conduct of that foreign policy is that it's had a dramatic impact on domestic policy. And that is, of course, C-24, I believe, you know, the stripping of citizenship, you know, and that's dramatic. That's a remarkable instance. It's not as dramatic as the British approach to this, which allows for the prospect of stripping British citizenship and making a person stateless, which is actually contrary to international law. C-24 does allow, at least, for dual nationals to retain one nationality, but the implication of that in having Canadian citizenship stripped is that that person may well be deported, that person may well be expelled, and of course the recipient country will then receive a convict of terrorism. And so effectively that results in an export of terrorism in a peculiar kind of way. Harper has created a sort of an industry, anticipating an industry of sorts. And this undermining of citizenship has translated itself, broadly speaking, because of this emphasis, this mania about expanding the war on Islamic State. I'm not suggesting for a minute that Islamic State doesn't pose a threat in the region. But the Canadian indifference, this is Harper's indifference to understanding the implications of an expanded bombing campaign, ineffectual, I might add. You know, this is one of the most bizarre things. It's, you know, ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State, they're all actually doing rather well. Their economy and their base is being sustained constantly, notwithstanding the fact that they are being bombed. And so there is this display of power, which is not actually very effectual at all, but it has very significant impacts on domestic legislation, on the security state. And the implications, certainly under Harper's time, are significant for the emergence of a considerably heavily involved surveillance state that has that views its citizens actually with suspicion, at least its citizens, except, of course, good Canadian stock and so forth.
Yeah. Mm. Now, there's also, in addition to the war against ISIS, you also have countries Syria and Iran, which are seen as enemies, the governments therein. And, of course, recently we've heard about how Russia has come to join the fight against ISIS, and that seems to be their approach seems to be turning the leaders of that the U.S. NATO folks off. And
yes, they've certainly introduced a sizable spanner in the works, and what they've done, of course, is they and let's not fall for the general idea that the Russian approach here is not to target Islamic State necessarily. I know the numerous media reports coming in suggesting that these particular positions are actually at FSA, you know, Free Syria Army units that supposedly the Russian Air Force is targeting. But as Robert Fisk pointed out very recently, it's a very peculiar thing to say that, you know, in Homs, for example, the area of Homs, that there were actually FSA units, because supposedly, according to the U.S. own debriefing from the State Department, those CIA-trained units were not there. They were disbanded in that particular area. So obviously, it was a bit peculiar to then suggest that they are there now, suddenly, you know, renascent. So that's one problem in this war of words and information. Again, we come back to the old story. What is it that we need to look at? What is it we need to read and engage in? But the second thing, too, of course, is that they have fundamentally different objectives on a certain level. You know, Russia is interested in controlling the Islamic threat because it has the Chechenian issue, of course. Remember, if you look geographically at the Russian context, Chechnya is south. It's not the Middle East. It's the southern east. It's the south, if you were. It's so relative to that quaint term, the Middle East to Western powers, the Russian context views it differently. Geographically speaking, Iran and the Arab states are focused in a very different league, a very different aspect of their strategy. But Chechnya looms large, and they have been Chechen recruits for ISIS. There have been Chechen participants, and a very notable Chechen leader has certainly figured in Islamic State. So that's that aspect to consider. But the other, of course, problem here from the you know, the NATO and the U.S. perspective, is that the policy is, of course, also to shore up Assad. It's to give him better leg room in terms of the conflict, whereas the U.S.-led approach with France, with Britain, has always made it clear that they want Assad to be removed. And Russia has made it clear that, no, Assad is doing a lot of the fighting, his forces are doing a lot of the fighting, and we need to bolster his efforts. But, and this is where, again, you can see the worldviews collide. You can see that they're very fundamentally different views about this. The U.S. are using that fabulously concocted notion of liberalism and liberal markets to tell and suggest that the Syrian leader, Bashar al-Assad, brutal, yes, admittedly, that he has to go, but they don't. They have come up with this nonsense term called transitional government. And we know what transitional governments look like. They look like Libya. They look like they look like Libya after Gaddafi. They look like Iraq after Saddam Hussein. So expect another instance of a repeat in Syria if that particular envisaged plan takes place. And that's what the Russians want to avoid.
Yeah. Now, you just brought up Libya, and I think it's kind of important because I know that you wrote a paper about Libya or contributed a paper on Libya about 2 years ago. And your appraisal of that whole – it was framed as a humanitarian intervention to protect the people from this brutal dictator. And I guess what was the – Syria, I suppose, would have been the taking that same approach to protect the people of Syria, and it doesn't seem to be working too well. But if you could talk about how that intervention in Syria has helped shape the not only the dialogue but the reality that's on display given the current confrontation with Syria.
Well, yes, the whole concept of protecting the people is used all too conveniently, and it's used to distinguish, for example, French, UK, US efforts and a part of that coalition from as opposed to Assad. He's always mentioned as using barrel bombs, and there's been, of course, the case of chemical weapons and a range of other weapons used. But the reality is that there's so many sides in this conflict. So many sides have a stake in the Syrian conflict, because it's in a sense at the front line of a series of global events writ large, where you've got the role of Iran and Hezbollah, you've got the role of Russia and its interest, and you've got the US side of the equation and how it sees stability or instability in this particular case, and trying to maintain leverage and influence over a country that's also deemed an enemy of Israel. So you've got a range of strategic factors that play into that. And the people are just the chess pieces, you know, of the scriptwriter. And yes, all sides are using the rhetoric of civilian deaths and using this in degree of protection. It's obvious that Assad is not particularly interested in protecting certain number of Syrians. The brutality of his armed forces is renowned, but by the same token, you can't exactly find sainted angels in the FSA, the Free Syria Army. The notion of a moderate Syrian opposition is of course quite absurd. How can one be moderate armed to the teeth and happy to also conduct one's own little cleansing campaigns? And added to that, of course, are different groupings with different
Al-Nusra?
Yes, exactly. Al-Nusra with and even Al-Nusra has disagreements at times with Al-Qaeda and so forth. And so you've got an Al-Qaeda grouping, you've got an Al-Nusra grouping, and you've got the associated peculiarities of ISIL and so forth. So what we have essentially are a range of groups that are promoting their agendas on Syrian soil, and the Syrian people are, of course, the ones to suffer from it. And occasionally they're idealized in UN resolutions, or they might be idealized in the context of humanitarian intervention. But you can't have, as I have mentioned before, you can't have humanitarian intervention at the end of a Tomahawk missile. It just does not work like that. Humanitarian intervention is grotesquely euphemistic, because it suggests a constructive notion when it's actually, at the end of the day, a warring destructive notion, which we pad around, essentially. And responsibility to protect, I'm very critical of the doctrine, even though I know it's very much the flavor in the human securities movement, and very much has been the flavor of international, at least attempts to discuss international law reforms. But the reality of it is that it's so often a cloak, a garb, a veil to justify realpolitik and genuine power interventions.
It's doing an end run against around the principle of sovereignty of nations.
Yes, exactly. Well, what it does is essentially it attacks sovereignty via the back door, and it just cloaks it under a different term.
Yeah, and it's telling the countries that are pushing for that. I mean, Russia has been against that. I mean, they're trying to support that principle of sovereignty of nations. And
yes, and of course, and again, I do understand that this is diplomacy is a feast of hypocrisies, and I do understand that it can be perceived that the Russian approach has not been particularly noble regarding Ukraine and notions of sovereignty there. But the principle still remains that critics of humanitarian intervention have a point in calling it. For example, Bricbon calls it, a form of imperialism, humanitarian imperialism, because ultimately humanity is used as a trick, as a plague. And in that particular case, it ends up with disastrous consequences, because the very people who are meant to be protected end up being injured, as we saw in cases like Libya, which is essentially being run now by a set of fiefdoms of various groupings and religious affiliations.
Mm. I noticed that there was a nuclear deal that was struck. And there's been some contention in the United States, but the president is essentially promoting this in principle. And interestingly enough, Canada has been particularly critical of Iran. They've been very guarded about the whole nuclear issue with Iran. What in your view, guides Canada's approach to Iran? I mean, they talk about it being a supporter of terrorism, but is that it, or is there a little something a
bit think,
more?
I think it has to do with the obviously. Well, I say it's obvious because it seems to certainly conform to a pattern that I've seen in the context of a good number of members of Congress, certainly the GOP, and also in other countries where any country that are willing to listen to Netanyahu, you know, the Israeli Prime Minister, you know, who is the one spreading the line that such an agreement is dangerous, that you cannot have an agreement with Iran, because it follows from the premise that because it is terrorist, you cannot negotiate with them. And this, of course, is one of those self-defeating illusory measures that means that you don't negotiate with anybody that you can just label a terrorist. Iran has, of course, been, you know, preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon is the primary concern. But it's the primary concern for the countries involved with the agreement to begin with. Even though I've always felt that this is a very dangerous process, I always thought it was deeply hypocritical for powers to get together, especially those who have it. And that's the problem with the, of course, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, it has been argued, may have prevented more countries from going nuclear. That may be true. But at its core is a principle of bribery, because the NPT is based on the principle that the countries who have nuclear weapons, well, we will eventually disband them, but not for now. And the countries who don't have nuclear weapons, well, you shouldn't have, and you don't have nuclear weapons, and you'll be in violation if you have nuclear weapons. But we will give you a concession. You can have cheap nuclear energy. So that was the trade-off. Now, the trade-off has been totally, you know, misplaced, at least historically, with Iran, and Iran was trying to play on that. So quite legitimately in the context of that. But the reality of it is that it's become so, or it's almost like a hysterical idea that if Iran gets the weapon, it will destabilize the region. There is a certain amount of truth in that. It's not even Israel itself, which could be, I mean, Israel would be a significant problem, having taken the stance that Iran is not going to be allowed to have a nuclear facility, nuclear weapon. But the Saudis have also made it clear that in the event that Iran gets a nuclear weapon, and this is something the Israelis play on, I want to add that the Israelis and the Saudis on this actually do see eye to eye, which is one of those curiosities that maybe your listeners may or may not be familiar with. The secret services of respective countries do have ties when it comes to dealing with Iran. And of course, Saudi Arabia is the great enemy of Iran. Historically, of course, the Sunni-Shia divide is made very bleak there, where you've got the Shiites represented by Iran, fundamentally so, and of course the Sunnis in the form of Saudi Arabia, and there you see that replayed in Syria as well. So the Saudis have also made it clear. In fact, there were some rumors that went around last year that in the event that Iran was to obtain a nuclear weapon, they would try to seek Pakistani help in obtaining a Pakistani nuclear option. So the nuclear weapons would be run by the Pakistanis, but essentially they would be placed on Saudi soil. So that was one of the rumors that were not entirely scotched, I think, to my satisfaction. So with all that said, and how does that come back and relate to the Canadian role? The Canadian role, I would say, is linked to that by virtue of swallowing the Netanyahu line of security. And certainly the U.S. line, not necessarily from Obama, but certainly from the GOP line, that particular line, has been swallowed by Harper on this. And he's almost wanting to make us, you know, again, it's one of those things where smaller states, you know, want to sound louder and bigger than they are. So he wants to make the impression that this is a fundamental point, to take the lead against terrorism. But this is, of course, a childish approach, because you cannot have a security resolution in Syria without Iran, and you cannot have a peaceful resolution in the Middle East of any of the crises happening there without Iran. And that's the fundamental point that someone like Prime Minister Harper seems to be missing.
Okay. Well, I think another very important thing that needs to be raised, because you just brought up Saudi Arabia, and they're one of the biggest, or one of our big, Canada's biggest customers for arms is Saudi Arabia. Yeah. So I wonder what you make of that reality, especially given that this is a country, Canada, the Canadian Prime Minister has been so robust in their opposition to terrorism. And, well, you know, Saudi Arabia is a major sponsor of terrorism. So,
well, yes, you just have to see also the treatment of, for example, the Shia minority in Yemen and the Saudi approach to not just supply the government response, but also to be involved in Saudi jets. And, well, jets supplied by countries like Canada have been involved with strafing positions connected with the Shia minority. There's been a blockade. It's been a vicious battle, in fact, that I think severely underreported. So the broader sense of that is Saudi has this strange relationship with Western countries. And that is largely, to a large extent, it's got to do also with its significance. Of course, again, there is a natural resource issue. It is a, you know, it is a commodities issue. It's oil, and they're still fundamentally very powerful. So there is that lingering issue. But the second thing, too, is that Saudi Arabia has been perceived as some kind of strategic balancer in the region. And so, obviously, there is this idea that it should keep tabs on things. But, of course, it is a terrible human rights abuser. And it's very peculiar, on the one hand, to hold Iran to account to certain abuses, but then not to hold Saudi Arabia. I also found it very a rich remark made by Prime Minister Harper the other day on the issue of this, the latest deal with Saudi Arabia in terms of selling more arms. And he would regard that as perfectly consistent to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, but no, we're not going to deal with the Russians on that, because they annexed Crimea and they're sort of backing militants in the Donbass or in Ukraine. So we have this typical Janus-faced approach, of course, to foreign policy, you know, which is fundamental and seems to be the modus operandi of the Harper government. And I dare say he's not the only one. I do wonder whether his replacement or new, should he lose office, I just wonder whether that's going to particularly change, because that will be a strong statement to say, well, you know, let us stop arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Because as you rightly pointed out, Saudi Arabia is a sponsor of various groups undermining and destabilizing regimes. Saudi Arabia is to be found everywhere in Syria.
And not exactly a Jeffersonian democracy.
No, certainly not. And they're not particularly interested in that. And in fact, again, for your listeners, it might be of interest for them if they would like to, from the security of their own computer, if not their workspace, look up the Saudi cables that were released recently by WikiLeaks. And they give also a dramatic picture about Saudi foreign policy and look at exactly those sorts of things about what an otherwise very opaque, archaic state as well in many ways, how it operates with certain degrees of sophistication in peddling information for Western consumption.
We've been speaking with Binoy Campmark. He was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge, and currently serves as senior lecturer in the School of Global Urban and Social Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. He joined us in CKW's Winnipeg studio. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. To share his thoughts about the nuclear deal signed between world powers and Iran back in July, and to put it in a geopolitical context, we're joined by Mahdi Darius Nazemroya. Mahdi Nazemroya is an award-winning author and geopolitical analyst and the author of The Globalization of NATO by Clarity Press. He's a sociologist and research associate at the Center for Research on Globalization and a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. He spoke to us in late September. I was wondering if you could maybe give us, help put that whole Iran nuclear deal in its proper context. What are some of the factors here that we really need to take into consideration when we assess you know, whether or not this is a good deal, all things considered.
All right. Well, it is important to note that the sanctions regime that the United States was enforcing with the European Union was more or less going to collapse because the Russians and the Chinese made it clear that if there wasn't a deal, they were going to go ahead with trade with the Europeans, start trade. And if this happened, I think other parties, such as the European Union, other countries in Asia, more or less would have been forced to also start trading with the Iranians to maintain their competitiveness, or for economic and geopolitical reasons, they would have in one way or another been forced to start trade with Iran. You have to also remember that this is a time when the United States and the European Union are clamping up sanctions on the Russian Federation, and that means to target Russia, the U.S. and its European Union allies are cutting trade and trade with the Russians. That means energy exports, and the European Union's primary source of energy is the Russian Federation next door. So if they're going to cut off energy supplies, hydrocarbons coming from Russia, natural gas, oil, they need to replace that energy source. And there's no other better source of energy for the European Union than Iran. Iran, before the sanctions, was one of the European Union's biggest energy trading partners, one of the main sources of energy. And because of the sanctions regime of the nuclear energy program that Tehran was running, the European Union cut those energy ties with Iran. But now that it's cutting ties with the Russians, it needs to replace the Russians. And it's the Iranians they need to replace the Russians with. So one way or another, they were going to have to trade with the Iranians. So the points are that the sanctions regime was not going to be maintained because the Russians and the Chinese made it very clear they're going to trade with the Iranians. Once they did, others would have followed along. And if the sanctions regime that the United States has engineered and constructed, if that sanctions structure fell apart, it would have devastating psychological effects on American power, because it would show the United States as a superpower, as one of the world's great powers, not able to enforce sanctions, and this would psychologically have an effect, and this is very bad for an empire. So the U.S. knew that it was forced to negotiate with the Iranians. It knew that it had to stop the sanctions, and then there's the fact that the sanctions against Russia cannot be increased while there's sanctions on Iran. The European Union needs some type of energy source. And the third factor is the economic momentum, the economic freezing, the economic slowdown in the United States and the European Union. So there's an economic decline in the European Union and the United States. And they view the Iranian markets as a way of helping at least mitigate this economic decline. So Iran is a very large country, 70 million people plus, also large population of foreigners are there. It has an educated population. It has an industrial base. It has markets, very large market for airplanes, for example. Possibly automobiles, many products. So they also saw this as an opening in a way to help the economies of the European Union and the United States.
Well, what about while we're on the topic of the sanctions? I mean, what about the Iranian economy? I mean, it was still being hurt by these sanctions, was it not?
The sanctions were definitely had an impact on the Iranian economy, but I also think that some things that are blamed on sanctions in the Iranian economy, I would argue have to do with neoliberalism in Iran. Now, Iran is there's a neoliberal the neoliberal paradigm is something that's been adopted by Iran, and I think some of the economic changes and even the economic complaints by Iranians, not just a result of sanctions. I think it's a result of neoliberal restructuring in Iran, economic restructuring. For example, subsidies, the oil in Iran, gasoline was subsidized by the government. Those subsidies have been taken away. Instead, they've given quotas, things like that. Those type of readjustments, the economic restructuring, I think, has also been a factor. Of course, there are going to be opponents of Iran. They will try to use this, what I'm saying, and try to blame everything exclusively on the Iranian government in Iran and say, well, it's neoliberal adjustments and it's blaming everything. That's not that isn't the case. The case is the sanctions had an effect, but at the same time, neoliberal economic restructuring also has an effect too. Iran's privatizing a lot of national structures, okay, ports, for example, you know, things that have been owned by the government, the state, they're being privatized to domestic capital or to domestic investors or foreign investors, you know, this has to be also taken into mind.
In terms of the United States and those larger Western interests, there's been a long-standing desire to control that region of the world, Iran. What exactly has the U.S. and its key partners tried to achieve there? You know, wage a war and institute a regime change directly? Fracture it? What were the range of strategies that were being contemplated, say, over the last decade or so?
Well, the United States has used a toolbox of different resources with its allies against Iran. Regime change has always been the ultimate goal, but it has also supported separatist movements, ones that are violent and resort to terrorism. So Iran's a country that Jimmy Carter actually said this. I'll paraphrase what he said. It's an island of stability, and it's surrounded by in an area filled with chaos. You might say. I'm paraphrasing Carter. You know, he said that, and after that, the Iran Revolution happened. But more or less, Iran is a country that's stable. There isn't violent crime. It's not high there. But the United States has tried to destabilize it. It supported terrorist movement, separatist terrorist movement in the province of Sistan and Baluchistan, which is on the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan in the west, in Khuzestan. There was, after the Americans and the British invaded Iraq in 2003, illegally invaded Iraq and occupied it. You know, terrorism started there on the border. You know, bombings. There's been support for terrorism, support for separatism, and at the same time, opposition groups. You know, they've tried to weaken Iran's resolve psychologically, and also to hurt its nuclear energy program by assassinating nuclear scientists. Information that I might add that the International Atomic Energy Agency had to have passed on about these scientists to the United States and Israel that led to their assassination. So the IAEA, you know, can't be trusted by the Iranians, and rightly so, in regards to passing on sensitive information that's endangered the lives of Iranian citizens and scientists. There's also the U.S. is what the State Department calls coercive diplomacy, you know, the threats of war, threats of regime change, actions in the United Nations Security Council, actions in the United Nations in general to put pressure on Iran. there's the Israeli threats. Their threats have been consistent. You know, they've always used threats on Iran. And, of course, anything to push for some type of color revolution in Iran. No, and anything that's divisional, so dividing the Iranian elite, dividing the Iranian population on political grounds, using existing cleavages in Iran to basically do anything to divide the country with the goal of regime change. And one organization that the United States has supported is the MEK, or MOK, the Mujahideen Khalq, which is an Iranian opposition group that has been basically based in Iraq. They fought against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war. They were on Saddam Hussein's side. It's tried to use this as a card. So when the United States and Britain invaded Iraq illegally again in 2003, they quickly took over Camp Ashraf, and they basically turned the MEK into clients. And they've used all types of means like this. And then, of course, there's the proxy war against Syria. What's happening in Syria has a lot to do with Iran. It's aimed against Iran, so they've targeted Iran's allies, whether they're in the Palestinian territories or whether it's in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and its allies in the March 8th alliance, which includes the biggest Christian party in Lebanon. Michel Aoun's Free Patriotic Movement, Soleiman Farangi's Al Marada Party, Nabi Berri's Amal Party or Amal Movement, Harakat Amal. Whether it's targeting these parties or the Syrian government, they've tried to weaken Iran in one means or another, regionally and internally.
At this point, would you be prepared to rule out any kind of an overt war with Iran like what we saw against Iraq in 2003?
The U.S. government has disregarded international law whenever it was in its interests. And it would have done so with Iran if it could have walked, if it was a walk in the park. But an attack on Iran is not a walk in the park. You know, this is a country that can defend itself. It has missile, ballistic missiles pointed at American bases in the region. You know, it can sink the American fleet. There was war games that simulated an American invasion of Iran. They saw that the U.S. fleet in the Persian Gulf would be annihilated. You know, the American ships would be sunk. And this is also a country that has allies. It is aligned at a regional level, not only with the Syrian government, but with various groups in Iraq, Lebanon, and Palestine. Okay, it has clout internationally, and it also is aligned to the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation, as well as several post-Soviet states. So the ramifications of an attack on Iran could escalate into a World War III scenario. They would go well beyond the borders of the Middle East and Southwest Asia. Europe and Africa would be the fronts in such a war. There would be ramifications there, and with the Russian or Chinese involvement, this is a World War III scenario, not just a regional war.
Now, how does this new approach to Iran, with the nuclear deal, what you essentially say is a face-saving concession in order to relax the sanctions, how does this impact on Russia? Or how does it strengthen the America and EU's hands against this new enemy that is, or new old enemy that is Russia?
Okay, well, I liked how you phrased it, this new old enemy. Well, this will allow them, as they think or calculate, to clamp up against the Russians, but in order for this to be as successful as they want, they need to co-opt the Iranians or to have an understanding with the Iranians to at least be neutral to some ends against the Russians. And I don't think that that's going to happen. The Iranians and the Russians are allies. They're strategic allies. Whether some people in Moscow or Tehran don't like it, that's the reality. That's the nature of the relationship. We can see them coordinating in Syria and the broader Middle East together. We can see them coordinating on global issues together. We can see they have their policies on Latin America. Although they are independent of one another, there is coordination by both sides. They coordinate in regards to terrorist threats. They have an understanding. They both have there's the Russian Security Council and the Iranian Security Council have coordination and contacts. Their military cooperation has been increasing. The Iranian defense ministers has made some high-level visits to Moscow and vice versa. The Russian defense minister, General of the Army, Sergei Shoigu, has been in Tehran. The contacts between them are increasingly becoming strategic and more important. Although there are differences to some level, they coordinate in regards to the Middle East, the Caucasus, specifically the South Caucasus, the Caspian Sea Basin, and Central Asia and Afghanistan. They coordinate in these areas where their interests overlap and to some degree are interlocked, including as well as the Eastern Mediterranean. They're both propping up the Syrian government and in many regards coordinating regards to global affairs. Okay, and they're also supportive of Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua. These countries, they both have good ties with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea or North Korea, and they're supportive of that against U.S. pressure, along with the Chinese. You know, the Chinese are part of this. China, Russia, and Iran make a Eurasian entente or a Eurasian triple entente. So there is a strategic alliance where there's an access between Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing, and the U.S. wants to spoil this. It basically wants to turn the Iranians against the Russians and to spoil any strategic alignment between them. And that's because the U.S. is targeting Russia now and trying to play the Iranians against the Russians, but that will not be successful at all.
I imagine another complicating factor is the United States' very close relationship with Israel, and Israel, at least outwardly, has nothing nice to say about Iran. It seems to me if you crush Iran, that's not going to be enough. So given that strategic partnership between the U.S. and Israel, one wonders if Iran owes the United States any favors, nuclear deal or no.
I don't think the United States is owed any favors by the Iranians. Tehran doesn't owe it any favors. I think any agreements they make are done for mutual benefit, and on the U.S. side, definitely out of necessity. I would add that it's not only Israel, it's Saudi Arabia that falls into this boat where it's not happy with the deal with Iran. But I want to point out that a lot of things you hear from the administration in Israel, of its premier, Prime Minister, or Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a lot of it is also for domestic consumption and also for to ensure that Israel's military is still being subsidized by the United States. I mean, in all honesty, to a degree, there is even Israeli products that are sold in Iran. You know, in fact, anti-war activists from North America were surprised when they went to Tehran, I think last year or the year before, when they found out that some Iranians were complaining that we are bringing products from Israel into the country. You know, there's a lot more to the picture that's unnoticed or goes unnoticed. I think a lot of the things that the Israelis say is rhetorical, especially in regards to the Netanyahu's government, including threats against Iran. Israel has no capabilities to launch a massive war against the Iranians. I mean, it does threaten war. It does have nuclear assets. It does want to maintain some sort of policy of, let's say, mutual assured destruction against Iran, by stationing Dolphin nuclear strike submarines in the Persian Gulf that could target Iran. But at the end of the day, it can't really execute a war against Iran as much as it postures. So they're two totally different levels. I don't think the Israelis militarily can defeat the Iranians.
Okay. So is there any risk, is there a realistic risk that a future president may just, like, as we're hearing all of these congressional or Senate Republicans trying to sabotage this nuclear deal, I don't know, are those feelings genuine? And if so, do you anticipate that a future president, say a Republican president, one of like Donald Trump, say, or whoever the next president should happen to be, that they could potentially change the, you know, go back on this and return to the previous, what you consider to be a very failed sanctions regime? That's are we seeing more of that same kind of rhetorical flourish?
Well, I think that there's rhetoric involved, definitely, but there's also tactical factors behind what's happening in the United States, aside from domestic politics. I think that we should note, I'd like audiences to note that whenever the U.S. Congress gets involved here, there are also considerations for getting further concessions from Iran, whether it's public or not. So the threats of not passing any nuclear, supporting any nuclear agreement, you know, they do get the U.S. concessions. When Israel threatens Iran, in many aspects, it coordinates with the U.S. government, and it gives the U.S. leverage. So this gives U.S. leverage in other terms. There's other negotiations going on. There's talks about other things going on. You know, these nuclear negotiations, the prelude to them was when the United States wanted to attack Syria a few years ago, you know, after the chemical weapons incident. Okay, the U.S. wanted to attack Syria. It postured like it was going to attack Syria, but in reality, if it did, this would have resulted in a broader war. But I think they did that to gain traction in negotiations with Iran, which had started through the Sultanate of Oman secretly, okay, which shocked American allies, and even because it was secretly done. The Saudis were not happy about that. It was secretly done. So the Iranians and the U.S. have been talking through back channels, and I think this gives it gives the U.S. room to maneuver to get concessions from Iran. And I want to point out that the U.S. has gotten concessions from Iran as well. This nuclear agreement that has been made by the P5 plus one, the permanent 5 plus one, which is Germany, meaning the permanent 5 Security Council members in Germany, or the EU plus EU 3 plus 3, okay, this agreement that's been made by them, more or less legitimizes illegal behavior. Okay, and what I mean by that is the nuclear, under the non-proliferation treaty, nuclear non-proliferation treaty, the NPT, Iran has an absolute right to enrich uranium. Okay, all countries have a right to enrich uranium for peaceful means. This nuclear agreement basically justifies Iran's rights being reduced. So concessions have been made to the United States. There's limits on the Iranian nuclear program that are unlawful, but Iran's agreed to go along with them to drop the sanctions. So concessions have been made. And what's happening in Congress and also in regards to U.S. domestic presidential politics, I want this to be noted very heavily. U.S. foreign policy is a continuum. It's a continuation. It doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or Republicans in power. It goes in a continuum. It's a structure that's very hard to change. Obama's government, the Obama administration, is a national unity administration. What I mean by national unity is that it was a coalition administration, which includes Democrats and Republicans. Let's not forget Robert Gates. His defense minister was a Republican. Other members of the staff and the administration were Republicans. Okay, Hillary Clinton was his Democratic opponent. She was brought in as the Secretary of State. After then, of course, she's been replaced now by John Kerry. But this is a government that has worked in consensus. It's a consensus of the American political establishment. So it's going to go on in a continuum. And I actually said this in an interview days before Donald Trump said, well, he said that he would maintain the nuclear agreement, but he would still press on the Iranians. So this agreement's going to be continued. The only time it won't be continued by the administration is if the U.S., wants to backstab the Iranians, but it's not going to be because of a change in politics. It's going to be because of an intentionally calculated move by the United States. And at the same time that the United States is talking to the Iranians, let's not forget what's happening in the Middle East and neighboring Iraq and Syria. You know, the so-called Islamic State, or as they say, as they call it by the Arabic acronym Daesh, or as you say, as we say in the English acronyms, ISIL or ISIS. This group has been nurtured to destabilize the region, to destabilize even Iran, because it's next door to Iran. Just like how Ukraine is being used to destabilize Russia and some other post-Soviet republics like Belarus. The situation in the Middle East next door to Iran is also being used to create instability there and to justify the marshalling of massive U.S. military assets, as well as a coalition of countries into that part of the world. You know, they're bombing Syria already, so regime change in Syria is not off the map, and they could eventually be used to target Iran. So, I mean, at the same time that this nuclear agreement's been made, this is what's happening. So Iran's very much still in the crosshairs.
Thanks for joining
us. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I look forward to talking to you once I'm back from Asia.
That was award-winning author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Nazemroya speaking to us in late September. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.